All right, so I'm going to talk about couplings between modes of stars which are rotating. Sort of a weak approximation to the full fluid evolution problem. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's been done and why I'm trying to do it in this way. I'm not doing this all in isolation, so I've been working on this and also in parallel with this group at Cornell, along with Phil Arras, who's here at this meeting right now, who are also working on basically the same approach to things, but some slightly different aspects of the problem. So it's sort of a complementary approach, all of our work here. And I'll just sort of, as maybe a little bit of a warning, when I was preparing this, I was feeling some trepidation, because I know that in the past, the interest that other people have had in my work has always been sort of inversely proportional to how difficult it is. And unfortunately, this is probably on the more difficult side. So I'll just... That's just my little laugh.
Welcome. Welcome to the real world. Say something that requires real thought to figure out everybody wants to cover.
So my first thought was I was giving this talk to people who are experts on R modes, and when I say modes of rotating stars, the whole motivation has got to do with R modes, but maybe there's a couple people in the audience who don't know what an R mode is, so I'll just give a really quick review of what this is all about. So an R-mode is just a solution of Newtonian fluid perturbation theory. And the R stands for Rossby, who was a geophysicist a long time ago who worked on these things. And the modes of rotating stars, and the restoring force is the Coriolis force in these stars. And so the R-modes are basically currents which live on a sphere, and if you look at the rotating fluid here, and you look in the flame which is rotating with the star, what you'll see are things exactly what you'd expect from the Coriolis force. You get little whirlpools going in one direction on the northern hemisphere, and little whirlpools going in the opposite direction on the southern hemisphere. And formally, the way this is written is saying that we have a perturbed velocity, which is on top of this rotating star, which is proportional to a curl of a spherical harmonic. Now, the thing that makes that's going to end up making all this interesting is the fact that these R modes are counter-rotating in the rotating. If you look in the frame, which is rotating with the rotating star, they're counter-rotating. And basically, when you solve the fluid perturbation theories, you find that the frequencies of these modes always have this value, where the frequency of the mode depends on the star's angular velocity. And then we've introduced a spherical harmonic which has M and L indices, and they come in here. And this is something that is negative definite. So this is saying that it's always counter-rotating in the rotating frame. But if you look in the frame, the initial frame, these things are always co-rotating. So they get dragged forward by the rotation of the star. Okay. So I'm not going to turn this into a talk on CFS and stability, but there's this famous thing, which was started back in the old days by Chandrasekhar. That's the C of CFS and stability. F is John Friedman, of course, and S is Bruno Schuchs. So basically, whenever you have modes, the short end of the story is whenever you have modes that have this property that they're counter-rotating in the rotating frame and co-rotating in the inertial frame, you can get an instability when you can couple to gravitational radiation reaction. So the Newtonian modes are just restored by Coriolis force, but once you add general relativity, you can get an instability which causes the modes to grow. And so this was sort of, people were just generally unaware of this until Niels came along and destroyed our lives and made us start working on this. Okay, and I'm not going to go through here, but basically this is the condition that is needed to be satisfied for instability, and it's satisfied for all L as long as the L is greater than 1. And I'm not going to go into any more theory of that. Okay, so these are solutions of linear perturbation theory, and coupling to gravitational radiation is suggesting that they're just going to keep on growing. However, we know that linear perturbation theory is not the full solution to the full fluid equations. And so this is only going to be an approximation to the real thing. And it turns out there's a lot of physical predictions which are based on how large you think that the mode is going to grow. It has some amplitude. How large is it going to get? So for instance, one of the reasons why many people have suddenly gotten interested in R modes is there's this prediction that we ought to maybe be able to observe these things from young neutron stars. Yes?
Very elementary question before you go down to
okay.
That picture you drew of an R mode shows like closed loops.
Yeah, that's, it's sort of, they sort of drift a little bit, but it's approximately that.
I'm having a hard time understanding how a closed loop could be prograde or retrograde, since it seems to be happening.
Okay, so that's the motion of the fluid itself, but when I write what the fluid velocity looks like in time, delta V looks like this YML, but it has some frequency with time. So that's just showing me when I watch it, it looks, this is what the fluid element is doing with time, but this is corresponding to an actual changing of the velocity at different places, which depends on this frequency. It's a mode solution.
Is the equator moving faster than the pole, so if it's going back at the equator and forward at the pole, it's actually
here, what it is really you're talking about what is the phase velocity. So there's two things. There's the fluid velocity, but then there's the phase velocity of the mode. So we could factor
right.
This thing has got an E to the IM phi. And so when I say that basically this frequency is either positive or negative, what I'm talking about is there's a phase velocity,
which is the mode.
So not the actual fluid. I mean, what that does is really just a red herring. It's got nothing to do with well.
I think what you're not quite saying is
okay.
In looking at the fluid motions, you're adding the rotation of the star, the velocity, the background velocity field to the perturbed velocity field, and that sum gives you the form of the fluid element's velocity field. If you look at the perturbation itself, that has this vector field that Sharon just wrote down, and it's that vector field, the perturbed velocity vector field, that has the pattern sweep that's negative and electric.
Yeah, so we can draw instantaneous lines of what's going on. And if you remember from Keith's talk yesterday, he showed these, it's sort of a different way to talk, but you don't have those transparencies with you. he showed these zones that look like so in instant time you have these zonal circulations that look kind of like this, but then they change with time. It's sort of that they add up to give the picture that I have. We would have to spend some time going
right.
to okay, so one of the things that we really want to know then is we have an instability. How large is this perturbation going to be able to get before it basically saturates, because the full theory is nonlinear. And really, everything we've been doing so far has been in linear perturbation theory, which doesn't tell us how large things can get. So we really need to go beyond linear perturbation theory to make some predictions about how large perturbations can get, which may help us make some decisions about how we're going to detect gravitational radiation, and also things like, can we melt the crust? Crust is starting, and all sorts of interesting physics questions. Okay, so first of all, what has been done so far? So there are two very nice studies that have already taken place, so maybe you don't even really need to hear about what I'm going to be up to doing. But anyways, Yuri and Gray, who are in this room over here, have done something probably in a similar spirit to what I'm talking about doing. But what they're doing is they're confining their they're only looking to R modes which live in a thin, incompressible shell, spherical shell. Well, I didn't really, I sort of glossed over this, but really what I've been talking about are things that are modes of the whole star as a whole, not just in the spherical shell. So I'm going to be talking about full modes of the star. But you can find a very nice exact solution if you look at just a thin shell, incompressible. And there's sort of this interesting thing that the linear R mode solution ends up being an exact solution to the nonlinear equations. I'm not even sure if I still understand why this happens, and Yuri, I'm sure, will explain this to us at some other point. But because they have these exact solutions, this allows them to see what happens in the nonlinear case. And they're sort of, what they've been telling me so far, so basically they're not seeing any saturation of the modes at any reasonable mode amplitude. And then there's really a very lovely study by Nick Sergiolis and Tony Font, who've done a fully non-linear evolution of the general relativistic fluid equations. Well, almost. They're doing the Cowling approximation, where they don't perturb the gravitational field. But it's quite remarkable what they've done so far. And they managed to evolve a rotating star for about 25 rotation periods. And they just see mode going, they don't see any saturation anyway. They don't see any hints of the thing being stopped by the nonlinear fluid. Yes?
What sort of amplitude did they put in for the mode at the beginning?
I think they had to start off with very high amplitude, if I remember rightly. Does anyone else remember?
A month and then.
Yeah, it was pretty high, right?
Very large. As large as. They started with a. There's a maximum velocity for emission specified.
Right.
With the fluid velocity, the speed of light, and so it went up to the maximum velocity and started with an amplitude of 1. Now, it went up.
Yeah, right.
And so it went over there.
Yeah, okay.
The saturation was C.
Yeah. Yes, Vicky. Okay.
I seem to recall when Keith talked yesterday, the simulations you were showing were for uniform density stars, but here you just mentioned the shell.
Oh, okay. So
I was just wondering, is that different? And
It's a little different in what happens in the thin shell that they were doing. You have to correct me if I'm wrong here. You don't get changes in the pressure and density. Well, if you look at the full fluid of a star, and in particular, just looking at any kind of equation state, it doesn't need to be incompressible. You'll get some density and pressure perturbations when you have an R mode. It's just that they're very small. So I think that is probably the biggest difference between. And okay. So I'm not sure, did that answer?
Well, I mean, it seems like two different things.
Let's say that the character of the velocity is the same, and that's why they're both being called R modes. And in particular, the R mode solutions of the full star tend to keep motion of the fluid within thin shells. So it's not a bad approximation to just say that. So there is some radial motion of the velocity in and out, but it's very tiny. So it's actually kind of good. Yeah, and that's important, I think. I mean, the G modes are important. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is looking at nonlinear effects in the weakly nonlinear regime. And the basic idea is to reduce the full nonlinear problem, which, you know, full Euler's equations, turn it into basically you have an infinite set of modes which are all coupled to each other weakly. So, yeah, sounds kind of scary. And what I'm going to talk about today, and I'll give you some preliminary results about this, is what happens when you just look at a system of just coupling R modes to other R modes and see what happens. And in particular, I can be looking at stars with a short travel square minute so that the perturbations are buoyant. And so basically, this would also allow G modes, but I'm looking at just a simple truncated set without G modes. Later on, G modes are going to be put in here. Shank, Harass, Catherine Shank, Harass, Anna Flanagan, Salt, Kolsky, and Ira Wasserman are looking at two things, the coupling of the hybrid modes that Keith talked about yesterday amongst each other. So that's important for the stars with zero Schwarzschild discriminant. And that's actually a very important case, because they're interesting modes, but also because that's going to be a very good comparison with what Nick and Tony did, because when they do these simulations, that's the same thing as having zero Schwarzschild discriminant in them. So understanding what happens in this weakly nonlinear case, I think, will be very important for comparing with other codes. But also because Keith's modes are very interesting, of course, too. And there's also going to be bringing in of G modes coupled with R modes, but that hasn't done yet. And I think Phil is going to be hopefully giving us some preliminary results on those things next week. Okay. I want to just give you sort of a sort of a hand wavy outline of what it is that we're up to when we're doing fluid perturbation theory in this weakly nonlinear case. So to do that, I'm just going to give you kind of an overview. Like, you probably all know what perturbation theory is anyways, but let's just go through it because it's kind of fun. So the basic idea is that you've got some family of exact solutions to your fluid equations, and each member of this family, each different solution of the equations is going to be given some value, some abstract parameter lambda. And so by changing lambda, you go from one solution to another solution. And the basic idea is that you can describe the solution of some fluid by pressure, density, gravitational field, and velocity. And you have to satisfy the fluid equations. So you've got mass conservation, gravitational field equation, and the Euler equation. So fluid perturbation theory comes about by choosing an equilibrium. So typically, it's pretty hard to find solutions. What you do is you start off with an equilibrium solution. So particularly, you could take a time-independent solution. And what I'm going to do is going to call that solution lambda equals zero. And then basically what we do is we just perturb around. That's one solution that we have. So the basic idea is that you're doing expansion in this parameter lambda. So lambda is equal to zero, and you're always looking for solutions which are fairly close to your equilibrium solution. And so basically, linear perturbation theory, as we all know, so the solutions of the R modes and everything, are just solutions where we set capital N equal to 1, so just keeping the first order things. So what I'm going to be talking about is going to one higher order in perturbation theory, capital N equals 2. So it's still not the full theory that I'm going to be talking about here, but it's an approximation. And I probably don't have to say too much more, but I'll just say that when we talk about linear perturbation theory, usually we introduce Lagrangian displacement, psi. But the basic idea is that if you have a trajectory of a fluid element in the equilibrium star, when you add the perturbation to it, it follows a new trajectory, which is described by the old trajectory plus the displacement, the psi. And this is basically the fundamentals behind Lagrangian perturbation theory. And I'm not going to say anything more about that, really, except that basically, by solving for psi, you're solving for the whole system. Because once you know the Lagrangian displacement, you know all the perturbation quantities. So really what we have to do then to do higher-order perturbation theories is have expressions for the changes in all the fluid variables, but to higher order in the Lagrangian displacement. Yes?
This will only give you zero frequency modes, will it?
What?
Will this give you zero frequency modes?
This thing?
No, just constant flows.
Why not? Why not?
You getting nonlinear order?
Yeah. Oh, nonlinear, so you're saying if I go to higher, I was going to say linear perturbation theory, sure does, I mean, you could do flow rotation as a perturbation level. But, I'm not sure if I understand even really.
For equals two, you couldn't get.
Why?
Modifications of the equilibrium, is that what you're asking? Yes, you can. It's quasi-linear theory. It could be that influences as well as the real.
Okay, so. Okay, so the basic idea here is basically I want to find a Hamiltonian which describes the fluid motion. And so you start off with the Hamiltonian for the equilibrium solution, which is just going to be sums of kinetic, internal, and gravitational potential energy. And the idea is that we basically want to look at expansions around the equilibrium. And that's going to give me a Hamiltonian. And once you have a Hamiltonian, you can describe your system. And so the idea is we're doing expansions in lambda, which is going to be equivalent to doing expansions in the Lagrangian displacement. And so, you know, so in this expansion I have here, E0 is the equilibrium Hamiltonian. E1 vanishes because it's equilibrium. E2 is the Hamiltonian, which is going, when you vary it, is going to be giving you the linear equations of motion, and E3 is what we're going to be using. So just then it's just basically a slog to go through, do the variations, and figure out what this should be. There's one nice thing which is kind of helpful, and that's that the third order change in the kinetic energy vanishes. So you only really have to worry about contributions from internal energy and gravitational energy.
I'm confused.
Yes.
You said lambda parameterize equilibrium solutions.
No, different, not equilibrium solutions. Different solutions. So lambda equals zero would be the equilibrium.
Oh, and only.
Yes, that's right. So it's an expansion around the equilibrium. What, pardon me?
It's just an amplitude.
You could think of it as a distance away from the equilibrium. Okay. So. Now, I'm assuming that no one's really that interested in knowing how one derives such a thing. And if anyone is interested in this, they should just talk to me afterwards. Just so that you know, sort of, in its full glory and gory, whatever, this is what it looks like. And so basically, I have something which is third order in the Lagrangian displacement, and variations of this is going to give me the corrections to linear theory. It's not great that, you know, that's what you have to work with.
Is there an obvious reason why T3 vanishes?
Or
this just happened?
It can be explained. I'm not sure if it'll make much sense to people who haven't studied much of the equations behind it, but the basic thing is T3, so this should be like rho v squared. Kinetic energy. And so you're basically looking at the perturbation of that. And it turns out, this ends up being the same thing as something called the Lagrangian change in the velocity. And the.
You could have easily said, no, there's
no obvious. Yeah. Well, I was sort of thinking about this the other day. Let me just write down one thing, and then I won't go any further. But so V squared is the velocity is dotted in with the metric, and these Lagrangian changes. I'm not going to be able to explain it. When you use the definition of Lagrangian change, which is different from what John usually uses, what most Newtonian astronomers do, this thing ends up being linear, and the Lagrangian change in GAV vanishes, and so you end up basically only getting quadratic terms in here. But that's kind of a mathematical, and I don't think I have a good physical explanation of that.
In your E3, this is the cubic part of E3, right?
Yes, yes.
And then there's a piece that's quadratic in side 1 squared times side 2.
Yeah, they're not showing you that, but you know that one. Yeah, right. So this is just the one term beyond that. Okay. I'll put that out just in case we want to look at that later on to look at size of terms. Okay, so what I'm going to do is do... So the basic idea is that we're going to truncate the Hamiltonian beyond this point here, so I should really have order on side board here, and use this as the Hamiltonian to describe things. And what I'm going to do is take the displacement and make it a sum of linear modes that we already know. So these are going to be solutions of linear perturbation theory. And then we add some amplitude, and this is, just happens to be the frequency sitting out there for convenience sake. And psi alpha of t, well, the first derivative of that in linear perturbation theory is just going to be the frequency of the mode. And what this ends up being is being basically what's something called action angle variables, which probably everyone studied a long time ago and has forgotten. But the basic idea is that you bring in new canonical variables called the action angle variables, which end up being these phases and also these amplitudes. And then you can solve for the change in the phase and the change in the amplitude with time once you have the Hamiltonian. So the idea is that psi here is the angle, j is the action. And it's just going to be a matter then of doing these expansions and getting some equations. So this is maybe just a few little technical points here. So the idea is that these things are normalized, these different modes are normalized with respect to the canonical energy so that you can get, so that they're orthogonal to each other. And there's a lot of issues in rotating frames to worry about, which Phil could tell you many things about. So once you do that, this allows you to write the linear.
How can you make them orthogonal?
This is just basically, so this
I can
is...
see how you can get the length of them to be 1, but how do you...
This is basically the...
If they just have a fixed frequency, how do you take linear combinations of them to actually make them orthogonal?
So this is the... So this I understand to be just basically the old proof, the proof that John had his old paper, John Burnian. So this is the canonical, what do you call it? This is the canonical energy, and this is this, what do you call it?
The symplectic.
This is the symplectic inner product that is conserved, and things are orthogonal. I mean, that was sort of the whole point in bringing in the canonical energy. This. Okay, so this is a very technical point.
So it's
symplectic,
isn't it anti-symmetric? So it doesn't
mean symplectic
in that region. The kinetical energy is proportional to symplectic product of the time derivative of the mode with the mode. So that's not zero. Orthogonality with respect to E2, which Sharon is writing out, is equivalent then for mode to orthogonality with respect to the anti-symmetric symplectic product.
Sorry. Yeah, so when you calculate this, it ends up being a time derivative in here on one of them. That's sort of a gory point, which I don't think many people are going to really appreciate or care about. So really, this is canonical energy, and it's not what you would be calling rotating frame energy. Okay, so in any case, the energy can be written as... So this is meant to be now the energy, the quadratic energy, which describes the energy of linear modes, and it's going to be my definition is basically that the action times the frequency is going to be the energy. That's my definitions, like this over here. So the total energy of all the linear modes is just the sum of all linear mode energies. And then there's this third order part, and basically I'm putting in that sum into the previous yucky-looking Hamiltonian that I had before, and you end up having these k's, which are going to be the coupling coefficients in between three different modes. and it's just going to be a large integral that has to be done with frequencies and three factors of energy coming in. So the crux of the calculation comes down to computing these three mode coefficients so that you have your Hamiltonian that you can evolve then. And basically, once you know what these coupling coefficients are, your Hamiltonian just looks like a sum of these linear terms and these and this nonlinear piece over here. And then you then can write down just basically Hamilton's equations, which tell you how the phase changes. And so the phase is going to change such that it goes like a linear mode frequency, plus corrections, which come from the nonlinear part. So there's this K, I've truncated all the indices for simplicity. It's going to be proportional to this grouping of energies here. And this is the cos of the phases. So this term is going to give us the correction to the frequencies due to the nonlinear interactions. And then you also get the change, you can also figure out how the amplitude is going to change. And basically, in linear theory, the amplitude doesn't change, so you don't have any nonlinear terms here, and all you have is nonlinear terms here. However, in the problem that we're interested in, the amplitudes will be changing due to either gravitational radiation if they're driven modes, or they may be damped by viscosity. So I'm going to just sort of ad hoc add in some dissipation terms, which are going to be the rates that either gravitational radiation or viscosity is going to be growing or damping a mode out. So this just means I'm going to be throwing in some terms over here to be either a driving or a damping term, which is going to be coming in also with the nonlinear stuff. Okay. So one question you might want to ask yourself, so I'm going to be calculating these coefficients and stuff, but what is it going to mean? Well, one thing that you can see is if you go back to the equations I have for the change in the phase, if we want to be staying in the weakly nonlinear theory, we really should be having that this nonlinear term should be smaller than 1. Or nonlinear theory just isn't going to be, this first order approximation just isn't going to be holding anymore. So that is a statement up here. So if we just look at group of three modes, this would be telling us then, and say we just set the energies of each mode to be equal, this would be telling us that the energy of the mode, and I'm doing this in dimensionless units now, where I would say the energy of the mode equals 1 means it has the same energy as the star. So the energy of the mode should be much less than kappa squared. So as long as this holds, this means that we're sort of in a valid regime for the approximations I'm talking about. And so it's really just going to be a matter then of figuring out what these kappas are. That's going to be telling me a little bit what I would believe in when I have these, although you've really got to do the full simulation. And then it's a matter of actually doing an evolution. Okay, so the Hamiltonian I showed you was fairly yucky looking. There's kind of a nice simplification which happens for the case of R modes, which is partially why I'm working on just the R modes. And that has to do with the ordering and the slow rotation approximation. And that's basically that the velocities tangential to the star are order omega, that the radial velocities are order omega cubed. So I'm saying omega is the angular velocity of the star, and we're in slow rotation approximation. Omega is something small here. And the pressure and density perturbations are order omega squared. So this means that a lot of terms in my original Hamiltonian can be neglected because it is going to be very small in the slow rotation approximation. And it means that you end up boiling down to a fairly simple compared to the previous yucky-looking Hamiltonian. So now I've boiled it down to two terms. So the thing that I thought was sort of interesting is that it ends up being proportional to the pressure perturbation. So if you're doing an approximation here where the pressure perturbation vanishes identically, which might be something you might want to do, you'd be finding that this term would be zero. So it's really actually important to calculate the modes to high enough order that you're getting these this pressure perturbation correctly. And anyone who's done any calculations with R modes will know that that's a bit of a bother, but it's not impossible. And these, well, one just has to sit down and calculate these things. So it's really just a matter now of calculating these integrals and solving the system. I'll just say a couple words on how do you figure out which modes can couple to each other. And basically, there's just some obvious selection rules. First of all, you know that the sum of the m's has to vanish because you're going to be integrating over all space. And there's also a parity selection rule, which is basically going to tell us that we can't, if we want to only look at modes with L equals M, they aren't going to couple to each other. And this has to do with basically the parity of R modes is goes as minus 1 to the L plus 1, which is different from the Fourier mode. And since we're going to be integrating these integrals over all space, the overall parity of the integral must be 1, of course. So the parity of my integrand when I choose three modes is going to go with the sum of the L's plus 1. So if I go around deciding to only look at L equals M R modes, which are the simplest ones to look at, then you're going to be finding that the unique this parity selection rule is going to tell you that the sum of the L's plus 1 must be even. But however, we also know that the sum of the absolute values of the M's that this thing must be even. And so this basically tells you that 1 equals 0, which of course doesn't hold in any approximation scheme. And so this means that you can never get groups of 3 L equals M R modes which will couple together. So this means that you can't do this. The simplest case would really be to only look at modes with L equals M. But this means that you really do have to go to modes that have L not equals M, which, again, if you've never done a calculation, then this thing that you won't appreciate this, but that does make it a little bit more complicated. And it does mean that you have to include a non-zero Schwarzschild discriminant if you want to look at it with R modes and G modes, or you should be going to the hybrid modes like Pete has it. Okay, so enough of this boring equations and stuff. What do I see? Okay, so I've done an integration here. So this is the sort of thing I might be wanting to look for. So I'm just sort of deliberately hiding some of this first.
What are you
talking? Pardon me? Oops. you'll see why in a second. Let's just leave it there and you can see what happens. So on the left-hand side, I've got a fraction of the energy in the mode compared to the star's energy. And I've put in a driving term to make the L equals M equals 2, R mode grow. I sort of accelerated a bit so that the simulation would finish in a short amount of time. And there are other modes in here, but they're sort of small enough amplitude that you're not seeing them here. But it's only when the mode gets up really, really large does it suddenly start coupling heavily with the other modes and it excites them, and that's what you're seeing here. And if this is what LIGO had to look at, this would be kind of a mess, right? Ben, how are you going to look at this? However...
Well, LIGO would love the 20, more energy of 20 times the stellar energy.
Yeah, exactly. So the paper didn't stay on, but of course, so what are these units here? Well, this is just crazy, of course, right? I mean, one is even too large. So this is saying that basically the mode is only, I'm not even sure if I call it saturated, but it's only crashing down and being limited at crazy energies where it has to be many multiples of the star's energy, which is, of course, not physics. And, I didn't put any physics like that into my code. I didn't tell it to stop at 1, for instance. So basically, I'm not seeing any saturation at any small levels of
the amplitude. You just got through saying that you needed to putting here L equals M equals 2.
Yeah.
But in order to get coupling to work, you need
to know
L equals M.
Yeah, so that's all these different,
under here.
Okay, so all the other colors here correspond to R modes with L less than or equal to 5, and they have various different values of M. So I'm not doing the complete set because I can't go to L equals infinity. And L equals 5 is about as high as I felt like doing at the moment.
Would you keep the magnitude of M less than L?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How much computer time are you going to waste?
Is special relativity in this?
No, it's just Newtonian.
It's just
Newtonian.
So it's physics. 10C.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. This is garbage, right? So
does this mean that the coupling coefficients, all those are small numbers?
So that is basically what I'm seeing, is that the coupling coefficients are small numbers, and so things like the delta P that I had to put in, while it's non-zero, it's still small. And
but
it's also got to do with how they overlap.
So that's non-zero.
And then the other thing I haven't talked about is that there are no resonances in this problem here.
So here, the moon is growing at some rate, but it looks like the star is not spinning down.
I have not put any spin down.
So one more time, if the star is spinning down, so the growth rate of the moon slows down. And so you buy more time for a couple of
things. I see. That's a good point.
So this thing actually peters. It doesn't go as a signal exponential.
Right, and that's what you were sort of talking about the other day, I think. That's a good point. And so that'd be something, that'd be maybe a little bit more physics to put in, right? Right.
Well, I'll just, when you integrate, you have to get this looking, turn on this kind of stuff.
Yeah, although, I mean.
So if you, suppose you did this without your guidance notes, so you just ask, if you start with an amplitude of unity, do you go for arbitrarily long times without seeing any leakage of energy into short wave arc flows?
Okay, so I wasn't seeing much of anything happening when I didn't put in the driving to get it larger, and I haven't done enough simulations to fully answer those questions, and so I'll certainly be looking at that. But for instance, so the other one, I put the R mode having a tenth of the energy of the star, so fairly high amplitude, and the other one's reasonably large too, like 100th the energy of the star.
This process depends on what is the amplitude of the R mode.
Most certainly.
Here you've got the other modes in there.
Yeah, so this is maybe a bit more, if you want to sort of see a scale that you can actually see something. You can see that there really are couplings. And the other modes are, so I've started all of them at the tenth of the energy of the star to give fairly high energy to see what's happening. You can see there's quite a lot of excitation of other modes. So I put in a driving force that it's not the dominant thing here right now. And you can see the amplitude is changing with time. However, it's still just really kind of going around the basic growth there. So if I wasn't telling it to grow, it wouldn't be seeing too much more. And you can see even the amplitudes, although I haven't really quantified this, the amplitudes seem to be increasing as I increase its energy as well. So I would say these are preliminary results, and I'm not... there's a bit more of the parameter space I ought to be exploring, of course, right? But it's not looking as though you really see any saturation coming in from these three-mode couplings.
So it's
certainly interaction.
As far as what you're seeing, it looks completely consistent with Sir Eulis.
Yes, most certainly.
No observed leakage of energy.
Yes, I would say that this is completely consistent with Font. It's consistent with what Greg and Yuri have done.
So the L naught equals to M modes.
Yeah.
They correspond to some value of one, or?
Yeah, I've here are the parameters I use. So maybe there's a question of whether if I use different models of Brunt-Fassella and all that, does that change? I'd be surprised. So what I was dealing with was just a polytropic model. What's that?
This is
kind of
really high.
So it's a very high Brunt frequency, yeah. So you might ask the question, what happens if I go to lower Brunt frequency, which would be more realistic? gamma equals, little gamma 4/3, kappa gamma 5/3. The other thing is I've only included the fundamental modes without radial modes. I somehow think that the fundamentals are going to be the strongest coupling ones, though. And so basically, the size of the coupling coefficients that I was computing tends to be typically smaller than 10 to the minus 2, which means that you really have to go to very high energy to be getting out of, getting close to the edge of the linear regime. And so, you know, that's, these are the numbers that are really
not that you have such large amplitudes, but if you had such large amplitudes, then you wouldn't justify stopping at simply 3-mode coupling.
Oh, well, at that point, I would probably say let's get some people to do the full numerical evolution.
The amplitude expansion has long since failed.
When you get, I mean, this should not be pushed beyond modes that make sense, I mean, really. And I think no one in their right mind wants to do the 4-mode expansion.
You mean just to work out the Hamiltonian?
That's maybe not too bad, but coding it up is probably another question. So, my speculation is that the couplings between G-modes and R-modes may end up being more important. One thing is that it's possible to get resonances between G-modes and R-modes, and this has to do with the R-modes are all linear in the angular velocity of the star, while the G-modes are not. So you can always, if you choose a certain Brunfels LF frequency, you should be able to find an angular velocity of the star, which will give you a match. So there could be some much stronger interactions with G-modes, is my guess, and I think that's going to be an important next step.
Out of curiosity, don't meteorologists know something about this problem?
One would hope so.
They've been talking about R modes and G modes for a long time, and this is a Newtonian problem you're doing.
Yeah. So the only things I was really looking at were the astroseismology literature. And there was some.
They wouldn't know much about this.
And
they feel like people work on the Earth.
And I really haven't looked at the meteorology literature. And that's a very good
thing. I mean, no one had done the R mode coupling. I didn't know G modes.
Euclid
done a lot of G-modes. Euclid.
Yeah, that's right. So Dizzy and Belsky had some work on R modes and G modes coupled together. Although it wasn't totally clear that it was applicable to what we were doing here.
Simple question. So what are the frequencies of the melodical stand modes?
I mean, they're just the usual formula. Yeah, I mean, it's just the usual.
There's still 2 m negative.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. It's just, they're allowed to exist if you have a short sum discriminant.
You still have two different things you can take which have radial modes, the R modes, which have internal modes, and the G modes, which have internal modes. Is there any reason to believe that the G modes would be better coupling than the R modes with internal modes?
Well, okay, so the R modes is internal modes, so you have to do radial integrals, and so the fundamental, you've got maybe some eigenfunction which looks like this, and then you look at the ones with nodes, and they'll have some oscillations like this, and when you do the integrals, they're not going to have as high amplitudes, and they're going to be wavier, and you think that they're not going to have as large when you do the integrals.
I'm just thinking the angle. So
That's a main part of it, and but it's also this radial interval too. I mean, it's the combination of the two. Yeah, but there's a question, if can you yank it up by using different radial eigenfunctions?
You have an infinity of them.
Yeah, you have an infinity. So maybe there's the question of, you know, is it going to be some strange thing where if I go to really high L, it's suddenly going to
fix up
by
N.
So that would be a next step to actually try to go through all those. It's just, it's a hard, it's hard to go through all that. So I'm just showing you the simplest first order approximation.
You said there are no resonances. That's when you limit yourself to L less than 5, or can you prove that in general that
there are no resonances? Yeah, this is sort of like a numerology kind of proof. With I did a proof with no resonances with L equals M equals 2. So I can't say that if I look at all the R modes of all different L's and M's, that's not the case. But you can also do a computer proof. So you just throw in the equations and you see what numbers you get out.
Well, so there's not going to be an exact resonance, but now if
there can be. You can get some. I mean, and also, so this is that first order in omega, right? And then there are omega cubed, or omega squared corrections, and that can come in too. But although
I would say, in a sense, the resonances between R modes, between three R modes, would be more interesting than the resonances with the G modes, because they don't change when you change the
And so that was my first thought, is that So that was my first thought, is that to look for resonances between R modes exactly like that. And if there were, that would be great.
This problem is the Shirokov resonance or something about it, because they have considered nonlinear coupling of positive weights to each other. He has a chapter on three modes of positive weights.
Oh, yeah, I just said you know that.
Say the meteorologists have thought about this kind of thing for a while.
So I'll have to delve into what's been done there.
Whether it's relevant or not,
it's like, exactly. So you do have the difference that I'm looking at a fluid ball, while the geophysicists are interested in a fluid shell. Although, on the other hand, we could be interested in accreting neutron stars, which Lars has talked about, Chad, the oceans on top. I mean, that's, at the moment, I find it simpler to look at this, but there could be some interesting insights from that, I agree.
Great, let's thank Sharon.
Yeah. You've had enough anyway.
Well, for a higher order coupling, because these R modes are related by ratios of small integers, you would get resonances. So
you say if I go to high enough, like nth order couplings?
Yeah, well.
They're probably, are you saying that there could be almost like a nonlinear, like a truly nonlinear solution that I'm not thinking of because of the information that
you're getting? Yeah, well, yeah. Right, I mean, you could figure it out. I think you would get it from the years. But it's at least, I think it's two, it's probably two or two of them. I don't think you can do it, you wouldn't want to write down the general theory, but it's not impossible that one could simply write down the order equation for just sort of mechanically take the product. I don't know.
That's a crazy one. Keep the charge. People go off and do an for replacement funding expansion.
It's a
16th order QED expansion too, but it takes a long time.
No, I think really the thing that really needs to be done is get QED. That's a point. I mean, next on that GR, it's kind of interesting. I think maybe if it's done in Newtonian, I don't know much about numerics, but I'm kind of guessing that one could do it for a more stable evolution rate. So if you only do it for 25 rotation period, presumably you could do it for a longer period.
But we still have to go for length scales where viscosity can dissipate stuff, so that's still length scales. That's just not.
No, if there were a strong coupling between the G modes and the R modes, would Nick and Jose, would they have seen that in their simulations?
So what they're doing is basically without short shots, because, I mean, it's really just the fluid equations, they're not adding in extra constants in there. So what they would be seeing is between the different hybrid modes that Nick is studying. And presumably if there was a resonant coupling, it would have given them some interesting stuff.
Maybe.
My guess.
But now they're using the Cowley approximation, I'm not sure.
Well, they don't have to draw a change.
Well, the Cowley shouldn't have.
I mean, the resonance and all that is really just a fluid, right?
But George showed this group in my pattern, and also they didn't put in a, they put in a large initial value for the R mode. They didn't, you could worry a little bit, they, at least in the piece I saw, they didn't put in a large initial value for the other ones. And, I mean, they could have just put in, they may have done it, put in some big random pretty rich, but it wasn't something that fits in the graphs they showed.
Great. Okay, so that's the last talk of the week.